Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm David Byrd reporting. It appears there's some doubt now that a trove of data files stolen from Islamic State will help unmask the terror group's foreign fighter network. Counterterrorism experts in the United States, Britain, Germany, and other countries are studying the tens of thousands of files obtained by Britain's Sky News from someone that it described as an Islamic State defector. The former IS fighter claimed he stole a memory stick from the head of the terror organization's internal security wing. The files are believed to hold information about more than 22,000 of the group's members, recruits, and sympathizers. Reports from Britain, Germany, and Syria say the files contain information about jihadists from 51 countries. But some Western intelligence officials and analysts contacted by VOA have raised concerns about the files, suggesting that genuine Islamic State information might be mixed with forged documents in order to drive up their sale price. U.S. defense officials say a key Islamic State operative captured by American forces last month has been transferred to Iraqi custody after providing the U.S.-led coalition with valuable information about the militant group's chemical weapons capabilities. Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook called Sleiman Daoud al-Bakr Islamic State's emir of chemical and traditional weapons manufacturing. He said the information Daoud has provided helped airstrikes against Islamic State chemical weapons sites.
We feel good about the damage we've done to that program, to that those capabilities, and again, it's going to inform our operations going forward.
The capture of the operative by a U.S. expeditionary force was reported earlier this month. This is VOA News. A group that monitors violence in Syria says an Islamic State militant described as the group's military commander was seriously injured but not killed in an airstrike last week. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Thursday that Tarkan Batirashvili, also known as Omar the Chechen, was taken after the strike to the Islamic State stronghold of Raqqa, Syria, for treatment. U.S. officials had said that he was likely killed by an airstrike near the northeastern town of al-Shaddadi. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Thursday that decisive and bold action is required to end sexual abuse and exploitation by U.N. peacekeepers. Speaking to the 15-nation U.N. Security Council, Ban said such abuse undermines the trust between the U.N. and the people it is sent to protect.
In the face of this disturbing trend across a number of our peacekeeping operations, it is imperative that our collective response is more effective.
The UN mission in the Central African Republic, MINUSCA, has been the subject of the most allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation, 22 last year and several more this year. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said Thursday there's no excuse for the Security Council shirking responsibility for peacekeepers' actions.
When armed groups, non-state actors, attack civilians, it is our job. When terrorists attack civilians, it is our job. So why in the world, when the UN's own peacekeepers are the ones attacking civilians, when peacekeepers commit the sickening crime of raping children, is it someone else's job?
UN Chief Ban has pursued a zero-tolerance policy against such crimes for several years, but cases have continued to rise. Syria's crisis will be among the focal points for U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry when he travels to Saudi Arabia and France later Friday. Kerry's talks with senior government officials in Saudi Arabia on Friday and Saturday will come as the UN makes plans to resume what's called substantive proximity talks between the Syrian regime and opposition about a political transition in that country. However, the opposition High Negotiations Committee has been sending mixed signals on whether it intends to return to the talks in Geneva Monday. The group has cited concerns about what it says are Syrian government violations of a cessation of hostilities that took effect in late February. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street Thursday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the NASDAQ were lower, but the S&P 500 was up 0.3%. For more, log on to our website. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Friday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Swaziland public sector workers consider nationwide protests to demand a pay increase.
So far, the reaction points to a possible mass rolling action in terms of protest to force government to concede on giving more salary increments to the middle and the lower sections of the public service.
Wandile Dludlu is the national coordinator of the Swaziland United Democratic Front. Sudan says it will soon release the findings of the two-year-long national dialogue. Zimbabwe considers policy reform to spur economic growth, and a rally planned today to urge the UN peacekeeping mission in Liberia to stay at the end of its mandate has been modified.
Upon the intervention of the special representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Thierry Monrovia, we have decided to select a delegation that will be making its way at the headquarters of the UN tomorrow to submit the petition.
Mwamba Molu is Vice Chairman for Operations and Mobilization of Liberia's main opposition Congress for Democratic Change Party. Tensions are high in eastern Cameroon over Chinese gold mining operations, and elephants in the Central African Republic are under threat from poachers and rebels. Those stories, plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Trade union groups in Swaziland say they are considering nationwide demonstrations to pressure the government to increase public sector workers' pay. The workers say a salary review report released by the government did very little for ordinary workers. King Mswati III's government has called on Swazis to tighten their belts this year. But Wandile Ludlu, national coordinator for a pro-democracy group known as the Swaziland United Democratic Front, says the unions are holding consultations with members to decide when to begin their protests.
All the public sector unions, they've not accepted most of the recommendation of the salary review report because it seems to give more money to the upper sections of the civil service and very little to the ones that need it the most, which is the middle and the lower sections of the public service, which have been calling it for the past 10 years, but it seems to be not necessarily addressing the very small and meagre salaries that they have been getting. So that's what basically caused shockwaves in most of the public sector unions.
How are these unions reacting? What are the steps that they have anticipated or plan to put in place to register their protest?
It seems from the meeting, the mass meetings of all three unions, the teacher union, the nurses, so far the reaction points to a possible mass rolling action in terms of protest to force government to concede on giving more salary increments to the middle and the lower sections of the public service, as most have been calling for.
There were also reports that after the government or Prime Minister Dlamini announced a state of emergency that needed funds, about 230 million of Emelengini that the country would need to help cushion the effect of the drought, some 94 Emelengini is going to be used as part of a process to purchase a presidential jet for the king. How is this playing in Swaziland?
My brother, you will know Swaziland remains a very undemocratic and very politically hostile country, especially on things that relate to the king. As you correctly have pointed out, 94 million has been set aside by the Prime Minister in the recent budget through the Ministry of Finance, reserved for the depositing of the king's debt. And there's been quite silence on that, not because Swazis are not necessarily angry or shocked about the confused priority, in the sense that on one hand, the country is plunging into a drought disaster. On one hand, the king has called in his speech from the throne that there must be tightening of belts by everybody. But government is seen loosening the belts on the spending on king's needs or wants, for lack of a better word. But because people are afraid to challenge the king openly.
Wandile Drudru is the national coordinator for pro-democracy group known as the Swaziland United Democratic Front. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. In Liberia, a rally planned for today, Friday, by a consortium of political parties and civil society groups to urge the United Nations mission in the country, also known as UNMIL, to stay after its mandate ends in June this year, has been modified. Momba Molu, vice chairman for operations and mobilizations for Liberia's main opposition party, Congress for Democratic Change, says instead of a mass rally, a delegation of 25 persons will present a petition to the UN mission in Liberia. He says the group wants to de-escalate rising tensions in the country following an appeal from the special representative of the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon.
Upon the intervention of the special representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations here in Monrovia, we have decided to select a delegation that will be making its way at the headquarters of the UN tomorrow to submit the petition. And so we've cut off the rally because of major security concerns.
Mr. Molba, why is it that you want to hold a demonstration for UNMIL not to leave Liberia?
The reason is the different security institutions are either under-equipped or are completely weak and doesn't have the capacity or the ability to respond to security emergencies that are known to undermine democratic governance in Liberia. On the other hand, you have a defense minister that is openly campaigning for a candidate and that has declared his support for the vice president. And he is the head of the army that has become fashionalized by that approach. On the third front, there is always an apparent controversy between the head of the presidential guard and that of the police inspector general, Honorable Chris Massaquoi. So in the midst of these different confrontation among members of the security sector, Liberia risked a return to the days of anarchy and chaos. So the only force that is viable enough and have got the confidence of the people to sort of provide the confidence one power into elections for national security and the protection of fundamental rights in the United Nations mission in Liberia. So we believe the government is underprepared to manage national security in the absence of UNMIL or in the midst of UNMIL drawdown. So we are petitioning the Security Council to readjust that resolution that called for UNMIL to drastically draw down its forces so as to extend its tenure, expand its capacity to remain on the ground until after 20-something elections when the adversary will have been fully prepared to manage its own security.
On the contrary, earlier this year, I spoke to the defense minister, Mr. Samukai, and he indicated that the Liberian military was ready to take over Liberia's security responsibilities after UNMIL leaves. But you are saying that they are not up to it.
That information is far-fetched. As we speak, James, there is a re-recruitment process launched by the Ministry of Defense, seeking to recruit new members of the armed forces of Liberia, because more than 50% of all those that were recruited in the last 5-6 years or so have either abandoned the military barracks and have reintegrated back into civilian life. So the pronouncement by the defense minister that you just reiterated is flawed, is unrealistic, and is unbelievable. There is a heavy agenda, heavy draft that still items want to succeed themselves. So the only way we can have free, fair, and credible democratic elections is to have the presence of a neutral force that will be a standby force to neutralize any threat that may come from either EPS or the police or the army that would destabilize and undermine the rule of law. So we believe that the only way Liberia is going to sustain the peace and move forward with democratic governance is the presence of a reasonable United Nations troop that will provide the basis for confidence and trust in the security sector going forward.
Momba Molu is vice chairman for operations and mobilization for Liberia's main opposition party, the Congress for Democratic Change. You are speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, March 11th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Sudanese government says the national dialogue initiated by President Omar al-Bashir 2 years ago has been successful. Authorities in Khartoum said the government will soon release the findings and recommendations of the dialogue to the public. Nabil Biagio of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Khartoum.
The purpose of Sudan's national dialogue is to address the political, economic, security, and governance issues in the country. The 14-member National Dialogue Committee, known as the 7 plus 7 mechanism, is expected to meet President Bashir and set a date for discussing the National Dialogue's final recommendations. Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's information minister.
We are almost coming to an end for the national dialogue, for both community dialogue and the political dialogue. The next step is going to be how to make arrangement for the differences which took place. And this is some exercise we do through mediators. After that, we'll hold a general meeting for the parties. We'll come and discuss the differences.
At the launch of the dialogue in 2014, major political parties like the National Ummah Party of Sadiq al-Mahdi and the then newly formed Reform Now Party of Ghazi Salah al-Din al-Atabani joined the process. The two parties, however, withdrew from the dialogue later, accusing the government of not allowing political freedoms and freedom of expression in the country. Other political parties and rebels from Darfur also boycotted the national dialogue. But Bilal insists the process will go on.
We will go with this document to be actually included in the next constitution, which is going to take place in the Sudan.
Critics of the government say the national dialogue will not solve Sudan's crisis, nor will it end the wars in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states. Haj Hamad is the executive director of the Social and Human Development Consultative Group, a Khartoum-based research think tank. He says the dialogue will give Mr. Bashir more power and legitimacy.
The minimum outcome should come out of the dialogue that they will amend the fences of the so-called Islamic movement, because it is already dispersed in the National People Congress, in the Reform Now, and in so many other important individuals who are defecting from the National Congress.
Hamad says the government still has a chance to undertake the national dialogue in good faith and respond to the demands of the people of Sudan, which include ending the wars, guaranteeing political and social freedoms, and the formation of an inclusive government in the country. Besides the ongoing national dialogue, the government is also negotiating with several armed groups in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Zimbabwe's Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa says the government is targeting an annual growth rate of between 6 and 10% in order to revamp the economy. But Chinamasa says for this to happen, Zimbabwe must embark on serious policy reforms as agreed to under the International Monetary Fund Staff Monitor Program. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Program reports from Harare.
Speaking at a meeting organized by his ministry and the IMF, Chinamasa said any policy changes would be difficult to undertake, but the country has no option.
Any reform agenda is painful, and I want to acknowledge the road that we've traveled, the journey that we've traveled has been very difficult, and is going to remain difficult.
He said Zimbabwe must pay its debt to the Bretton Woods institutions and mend its relations with international creditors so as to attract new funding to revamp the economy.
We need to make friends. We don't need enemies, especially if those enemies, or if you call them enemies, lend you money.
Visiting IMF head of mission, Domenico Fanica said Zimbabwe has many options to revamp its economy, adding that for this to happen, it must implement reforms now.
The message is that if you don't start the transformation now, when are we going to go? Zimbabwe cannot wait.
Economist Ashok Chakravart echoed the same sentiments, noting that while reforms were critical for the country to move forward, there was a strong resistance to change at all levels.
We have a lot of vested interests within the structure of government which resist the policy reform measures of the government itself. There is the willingness at the top to change the laws, the regulations and policies, but there's massive resistance all the way down, you know, to the local level to bring about this change. So I'm not sure what can be done.
Some of the reforms agreed between Zimbabwe and the IMF include compensation for evicted white commercial farmers, the reduction of the public sector wage bill, and labor reforms. According to the IMF, Zimbabwe has met all quantitative targets and structural benchmarks under the third and final review of the Staff Monitored Program. The IMF board is set to review Zimbabwe's position in May this year. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Tensions are brewing in eastern Cameroon between residents and small-scale Chinese gold miners who began setting up camps there 6 years ago. Local miners said the Chinese have taken away their livelihoods and are not living up to promises they made to develop the area. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from the town of Bitare Oya.
Local miners began extracting gold around Bitare Oya in 2007. 3 years later, the Chinese arrived. Miner Emmanuel Manga says he couldn't compete and had to become a commercial motor driver. He says he now makes barely $60 a month, a quarter of what he used to earn.
Sincèrement, il faut qu'il laisse les Camerounais amener des petites activités.
He says Cameroon should not allow Chinese to go so far as digging their gold fields or hiring laborers for very little wages to dig. He says it has made them poor. About 300 Chinese miners are now working in the area, far more than the 100 authorized by Cameroonian authorities. The Chinese miners use caterpillar tractors and equipment that clean stones and stiff soil, allowing them to detect gold faster than locals who use manual tools. Angry locals have responded by slashing tires, vandalizing equipment, and even beating some Chinese miners. Dozens of the Chinese have fled for safety to neighboring towns and only visit to oversee their businesses. Adamu Asamu, the traditional ruler of the locality, says locals have not seen any sign of the development they were promised.
Le gouverneur avait ordonné que tous ceux qui vont entrer ici comme Chinois pour être.
He says they were told by the local authorities that all Chinese gold miners had to buy pieces of land and construct beautiful houses in their villages. But he says that has not happened. He says the Chinese have instead built temporary camps near their mining areas and they don't close the open pits they dig when they are finished. He says they only see Chinese miners in town when they come to buy food. Locals say the gold exploitation also leaves polluted holes and destroys vegetation and animal habitats. But Chinese gold miner Chris Ho says his company, which is operating with a temporary permit, has provided roads, generators, and safe drinking water. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bitare Oya, Cameroon.
After years of violence and political unrest, the Central African Republic has just one operational national park. It is located in a remote area rich in gold and diamonds, as well as illegal ivory. VOA's Tatiana Mossad visited one of the world's last sanctuaries for forest elephants and filed this report.
Rangers at the Tsanga Tsanga Reserve set fire to nearly 300 weapons and more than 36,000 traps taken from poachers who are threatening this UNESCO World Heritage Site near the Central African Republic's borders with Cameroon and Congo. Albert Christian Junior Ndade says the poachers are well organized.
What makes this more difficult is that we are where three countries share a border. If there is a poacher in Cameroon who takes a protected item from Central African territory, it becomes difficult to pursue him legally.
Fewer than 60 rangers work to protect endangered forest elephants across an area of more than 1,200 square kilometers of parkland. The World Wildlife Fund estimates that nearly two-thirds of these species has already disappeared from the country, with only 150 or so forest elephants thought to remain within the park. Ranger Pascal Dombino says the poachers are adept at hunting the animals.
The poachers look for the place where the elephants gather to take them down. There is a real danger when the females are with calves. You have to be really careful because she might charge you.
Farther along the trail, we see what he means. A female forest elephant, whether he had found out, presents a threatening posture to the patrol as she protects her young.
When she sees us here and she has her calf, she now seeks to attack us. We need to avoid that. We can change our route to go around the elephant's position and continue our patrol.
Patrols for park rangers here usually last more than 1 week. But with limited training and few radios, technical advisor Guillaume Dubosc says it's an uphill fight against an illegal ivory network supplied by local pygmy poachers.
Because of their knowledge of the forest, the pygmy people are the best hunters. They can shoot forest elephants as close as 30 meters. Ivory sells here for $50 per kilo, but more than 250 after it reaches Cameroon and 2,000 in China.
It is not just poachers who threaten forest elephants in the Central African Republic. Anti-government rebels killed 26 elephants in the park during violence in 2014. Researchers here said that unless the killing is stopped, all the forest elephants in this area will disappear within a decade. Tatiana Mosso, VOA News, Tsangatsanga, Central African Republic.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Morocco host Ghana in the Africa Women's FIFA Under-17 World Cup qualifier in Casablanca today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Nigeria welcomes South Africa as Cameroon encounter Ethiopia. In rugby news, South Africa plays Scotland as Kenya face Portugal at the start of their campaigns at the IRB 7 series in Vancouver, Canada tomorrow, Saturday. Seeded in Group C, South Africa will also face Brazil and Argentina, while Kenya engage Samoa and Fiji in other Group C preliminaries. At the start of this seventh leg in the nine-leg series, South Africa are second in the overall standings with 86 points. Kenya is eighth with 52 points and Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. Turning to athletics, the Africa Cross Country Championship takes place in Yaounde, Cameroon tomorrow, Saturday. Athletes are vying for honors in senior men's 10 kilometers, senior women's 8 kilometers, junior men's 10 kilometers, and junior women's 6 kilometers. One of South Africa's emerging talents, Glenrose Kaba, makes her debut at this continental event. Earlier on, I caught up with her while she was in training and asked her what she hopes to achieve when she competes in the senior women's 8 kilometers in Yaounde.
My aim this year is to come top 20 in the African cross country and qualify for the Olympics.
In which event?
In the Olympics. I'm looking for 5,000 because coach said I must try 5,000 to qualify.
That was Glenrose Kaba, South African cross-country runner, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, the city of Tampere in Finland will stage the 2018 World Junior Athletics Championships, the World Athletics Governing Body, IAAF, revealed in Monaco on Thursday. The IAAF disclosed that the city of Valencia in Spain is venue for the 2018 World Half Marathon Championships, while the 2018 IAAF Continental Cup will be contested in Ostrava in the Czech Republic. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The global human rights watchdog, Amnesty International, has accused South Sudan's military forces of suffocating 60 men and boys in the shipping container. And that's it for this Friday, March 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jim and Cook. I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou addresses kidney disease and transplant. Our guest is Iya Bekondo, kidney transplant recipient, founder and CEO of the Iya Foundation. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.